Hi, this is David Ehrlich, and you are listening to The Letterboxd Show. I'm here to talk about my four favorite movies, or at least the four favorites that I picked for the purposes of this podcast episode. Akiru, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, and a little film called Titanic.
Hello, and welcome to The Letterboxd Show, our flagship podcast about the movies people love. I'm Slim, co-hosting with Mitchell, and we have as our guest one of the big ones. We're checking him off the list. Can you imagine having 126,000 followers on Letterboxd? Would you survive? We'll find out in this conversation.
Step one is to turn off comments on all of your reviews. That'll extend your lifespan by quite a bit. No, you guys are the big ones to me. It feels like it was just yesterday that I got drunk on the floor of my brother's apartment and decided to sign up for Letterboxd 10 years ago. And here you guys are fucking running shit now. It is I who am honored to be here with you.
Fucking running shit is how I like Letterboxd to be described. That's how I have it on all my business cards. Yeah. Mitchell Beaupre, Letterboxd, fucking running shit.
Signature on Gemma's email account. So I figured that was sort of an official party line around the Letterboxd offices.
Well, Babby, maybe we could start off with a little bit about that, because you have been, like me, you've been around since pretty early days, Letterboxd. You mentioned like over a decade now. Has Letterboxd, like the vibe of it, changed for you being on it over the last 10 years?
Well, I have a very peculiar relationship to Letterboxd. I don't really feel like I use the platform to its fullest and really engage with it like the way so many people do. I sort of just use it as a repository for the things that I write professionally. And it's been awesome that people have engaged with it there. And I've followed a couple of my friends, but I tend to really get the most out of Letterboxd when I'm just searching for a particular movie and seeing what a bunch of a wide array of people I don't know have to say about often very obscure and esoteric films, because virtually any movie you can think of has, someone out there has some kind of opinion about it. Mm-hmm. And that opinion tends to be, more easily found on Letterboxd than anywhere else. So that, the vibe has changed, but Letterboxd as a catalog, as a repository for those sort of thoughts has gotten a lot deeper. Completely supplanted like the IMDb's of the world for that sort of thing. And that's definitely for the better. I feel sort of secondhand that it's become this increasingly vibrant and, inevitably as a result of that, also sort of volatile community. But I do feel like kind of I have one foot in and one foot out, because I don't really look at it so much as I just sort of try and treat it like a platform instead of a two-way street.
Right. We talk about that a lot on the show, about how you could ask 10 people and they're all use it Letterboxd 10 different ways. So you're IndieWire's chief film critic. So a lot of the ways that you use it is kind of that somewhat longer form than is what popular on Letterboxd, and then a link out to your reviews. I mean, so many people read your longer form reviews on IndieWire. So it's exciting for people to kind of see that as almost like a teaser.
The amount of times that people have come up to me and said, that they read my reviews on Letterboxd with like no indication that they are aware that they link somewhere else or that I write for a living. It's so much more often that happens when someone says that they read my reviews on the website where I work. So they do link somewhere, but I'm happy people are reading them, or a portion of them, anywhere they can find them.
Right.
Letterboxd chief film critic, David Ehrlich.
Are you guys trying to get me killed?
Salary of $0 a year on Letterboxd, by the way.
Yeah. But the salary not wildly different from the one that most film critics get paid.
I wanted to mention too, like, you have, as Slim mentioned, over 100,000 followers on Letterboxd, and you also, one of the big things that people know you for is these video countdowns you do at the end of every year of your top 25 of each year. And they're always like this hugely anticipated events. Like, Twitter blows up whenever you've got them coming. And I noticed for 2022, I saw it when you dropped it. I didn't see how many views like it got up to. And I checked back on it today, and it's almost 100,000 views on Vimeo on your 2022 one. And I was curious, because those things have blown up so much, do you feel kind of more pressure with those each year? Did you ever expect when you started doing them that they would like garner so much attention and anticipation?
Oh, definitely not. They've actually gotten significantly less popular numerically, because there used to be an entire economy of websites that existed that would share them. And all of those websites existed, and all those people You don't no longer exist, and a lot of jobs were lost, and that's the media landscape of the last 10 years. But in terms of the people who matter to me and to whom these videos seem to matter in return, I guess in that sense, that community has grown larger. I feel a lot more pressure every year, and it's very, very silly because it's like such a silly project to begin with. To feel any sort of pressure is a bit ridiculous, but I like to feel, I get very into very silly projects and need to sort of force my all into them. I think something like that can only exist if I apply like every ounce of whatever I can bring to it. And so I started using them as sort of charity fund drivers a couple of years ago. And that has sort of supplanted whatever other pressure I put on myself. It was like the real pressure for me is wanting to raise the money for these causes. I also feel like it's the same fucking thing every year, and I think it'd be really susceptible to diminishing returns. And so you hope to keep them interesting for people. And every year that I am able to meet my charity fundraiser goal, the condition is that I'll make one for the following year. So it's sort of like a prison that I've created for myself for a good cause. Yeah, and if one year I don't meet that goal, which I continue raising every year in the like twisted hope that I'll fall short and we'll be
You're
free.
Just begging people to not donate the money.
it's a win-win. Either I raise money for a good cause or I'm released from this hell.
That prison, not unlike my own prison of doing the dishes every night.
Oh, I got to do that house. Too, man. Oh,
I'm God, doing that dude. Literally the second we stop recording.
It's like a double whammy.
Big night plan for the three of us after this recording.
It's also like kind of hellish to, because I have, again, all of it's arbitrary. This arbitrary rule of using music and those from the films of the given year that I'm editing together. And so to watch a movie and just to have a portion of your brain clocking the needle drops to the score cues and be like, oh, I can use it for this and that. And inevitably, I think spending so much time on a project like that fucks with the way that you watch movies in the first place. It's just really dangerous. But I try to remain cognizant of that.
As of right now, your first movie from 1952, directed by Akira Kurosawa, Ikiru. The synopsis follows a middle-aged man who has worked in the same monotonous bureaucratic position for decades. Learning he has cancer, he starts to look for the meaning of life. And this one's no joke. This is number 25 on the Letterboxd Top 250, and it's the highest-rated film of 1952. Do you remember how old you were when you first saw this movie, where you were in life and its impact at that time compared to now?
I sure do. I have to imagine that its popularity has kind of skyrocketed over the last, like during the age of Letterboxd, if you will. It feels like this was something that like Roger Ebert was championing and was sort of on his own island with this being maybe Kurosawa's greatest film once upon a time. And now it feels like it's increasingly consensus opinion. But to answer your question, my sort of cinephilia, if I can use that dirty word, I remember sort of its origins were I must have given enough of a shit about movies to feel compelled to steal my mom's credit card and go on Amazon, which was then basically just selling books and DVDs, and order the Criterion collection disc of Seven Samurai when I was in ninth grade. So like something I must have, that was unusually bold for me. And so I really must have felt some sort of strong inclination to do that. But I did, and I watched Seven Samurai, and that was transformative for me. And then I decided I really wanted to see more films by Kurosawa. I'm very much the type who, if I read a book by an author I love or see a film by a filmmaker I love, I just want to burn through everything that they ever made. And I quickly found my way to Ikiru. And I think I was probably still a teenager the first time I saw it. Even at that age, I think simplicity, despite the complexity of its design, it hit me so directly as far as like what life means, especially for like a agnostic / atheistic type like myself, who is often, and especially at that age, looking for meaning, to find the answer that this movie opened up, so hopeful, so simple, and so grounded and realistic, I think really jarred me awake in a lot of ways. I wish I had a particular like flashbulb memory of, I'm sure like so many of the movies I saw at that time, it was just like lying semi-conscious on a couch in a room with a Criterion DVD nearby, but it stuck with me.
Yeah, it's like there are times where I think this is like maybe the like saddest, most heartbreaking movie of all time. But then it's also, as you said, like a very meaningful, like uplifting movie in a weird ways. But it's also one thing that I forget about it is how funny it is in moments, like all of the insults that like the workmates have for each other, like human carp windsock, lips always flapping, but just air inside. Jelly noodles, like it's all the things
to describe me as a teenager and now. So I think that's like one of the things I've always related to Takashi Shimura's character in this movie. Yeah, and I think his performance here, you know, so different from his performance in Seven Samurai, resonates with the introvert in all of us, in the mopey side of ourselves, which certainly at that age I had. But you're speaking to like the grand meaning of it, just the. Yeah, like the finite nature of life, the impact that you can have, the meaning you can find in it is just sort of the good that you can do for other people, and the how infinite the smallest marks that you leave behind can be. I think that there's real profundity in that that I often find lacking in more sweeping pronouncements of faith.
George left a review on Letterboxd. I came home tonight and all I wanted to do was sleep. Instead, I watched this 2.5-hour contemplative masterclass and spent the last moments of my Saturday questioning the meaning of life and whether or not I was put on this planet with a purpose. I have yet to find my answers, and I can assure you that the themes of this film will keep me awake at night. I was thinking about this type of movie, not just after I watched, this is the first time viewing for me. I had never watched this yet until in preparation for this interview. I thought about how like these kinds of movies make you think back on like decisions you made or have not made. And then that kind of type of movie really hit me in the face today. I was at a screening for Past Lives. Mm. I saw Past Lives I saw it like, man, these movies, I feel like Past Lives, you know, I don't want to trump it up too much, but Past Lives also—
Some would say it's the Ikiru of its time.
Yes, some would say. I would co-sign that. I would heart that review. But those types of movies, they really resonate with people. And I think what you had mentioned earlier about how this is like kind of going up the letterbox list, it's almost like it's this, like a circle. Like people watch this movie, they see the comments like George's review, your thoughts on this review, and they just start to resonate so hard where you're like, you can sit and stew about your own life and think about choices you made. I think that's important.
Yeah, I think meaning of life movies are a very, very difficult and ill-advised subgenre. But when, you know, when you're distilling it down to the story about a dying bureaucrat who's been walked over his entire life and just been a cog in the greater machine of Tokyo's post-war economy, and he sort of finds meaning. I don't want to spoil the movie necessarily, but it's in a very sort of small act that has a lasting yet invisible impact. I mean, the people won't necessarily be able to trace back to him personally. The way that Kurosawa rendered it feels so, I mean, it's so resonant, it's so touching, and it's also, it just speaks, especially as I grow older and, you know, think about my own sort of shortcomings in life and your dreams, whatever you may have had for childhood, for most of us anyway, begin to sort of wilt into the reality that they're left with, and looking for the joy in that reality and thinking about my kids and how they are probably going to be the greatest impact that I make on this life on a long enough timeline, and finding the meaning in that. And yeah, I mean, it speaks to all of this. It does so in a way that is never the least bit cloying and is always sort of coldly, brusquely, brutally honest. And that's reflected in the film's structure, which is very unusual. It sort of allows the realization that we're speaking to gradually be sort of percolate through a very unexpected group of people, and the circuitous way that Kurosawa over the course of 150 minutes sort of circles around this one lasting image at the end of the film rather than sort of hammer it on the head. It's really indelible to me. There's nothing quite like it, including last year's Kazuo Ishiguro scripted remake Living, which for me felt a bit like a shrunken photocopy despite how good Bill Nye was. But yeah, there are some movies. I would say all of the movies that I've picked for this episode, which, you know, gun to my head, may not be my four favorite movies of all time, but are at least four that I felt like talking about, feel like they have a unique power to them, that they're greater than the sum of their parts. There is a sort of ethereal charge to them.
Mm.
I wanted to shout out Chris's review from Letterboxd, who said that Ikiru is not the funniest, but definitely the most emotionally affecting episode of Parks and Recreation I've ever seen, which I think does speak to, you know, that element that you were hinting at about what this guy's trying to do, but also about what, which I think a lot of Parks and Recreation does too, like what the meaning of community is and what, like, the services that we provide for the people around us and kind of what we leave behind in that sense. Like, your legacy doesn't have to be, you know, this grandiose kind of thing that you're leaving behind. It can be something small and simple, but you can still be leaving behind a legacy that leaves the world a little bit better than it was when you came into it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, I feel like Parks and Recreation is like a very Obama-ized
version.
I think, you know, on a long enough timeline, the act that the protagonist commits ultimately in the Kiru is going to be as significant as some of the most famous figures we have of the 20th and 21st centuries. I mean, it's just, it all flattens out and they're all, I think, sort of equally meaningful in their way. I think so much of the power of Ikiru comes from how small the act in question is. It is not life-saving for anyone. It's not an overly noble thing. It's just a little grace note in life, but it has extra power because of that.
How about that doctor not telling him the true diagnosis right at the onset of the movie, and then him knowing too?
Pretty brutal way to open a film. There's so many traps that hadn't even been invented yet, really, in some regards, that Ikiru manages to avoid. And you know, all of these tropes that would sink a lesser film, Ikiru confronts head on and finds ways to make feel honest and real. Even if this is, you know, a very intricately structured drama. And you know, I can't say enough about Takashi Kimura, his performance, which is, I think it feels very heightened despite how sort of reserved it is. There's something heightened about how little he seems to be doing. But that makes it all the more powerful for me.
Things are going to get better.
Let's move into talking about Jason Segel's performance in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, directed by Nicholas Stoller, written by Segel, co-produced by Judd Apatow, 3.4 average on Letterboxd. The synopsis: when TV star Sarah Marshall dumps an aspiring but depressed musician, Peter, he heads to Hawaii to escape from his heartbreak, only to find that Sarah and her new lover, Aldous Snow, are holidaying at the same hotel. You hate it when that happens.
We've all been there.
There's hope in the form of beautiful concierge Rachel, played by Mila Kunis. David, I've been familiar with you as like an internet presence. I've heard you on podcasts before. And as long as I've known you, I've associated you with your love of Forgetting Sarah Marshall. So please take us back to where that all began for you, the obsessive love.
It started when my girlfriend Kristen Bell broke up with me and I went on a holiday and I found myself with the Yoba Mila Kunis and I was like, if only a movie understood my pain. And
there's only one.
there should be more. Aren't they both in Bad Moms? I want to say I never saw that movie.
They are. They're two of the Bad Moms. I saw that twice in theaters.
My loyalty to this film would require me to see both Bad Moms and A Bad Moms Christmas. If they made A Bad Moms Hanukkah, I would have to think about it. But as I said when we were talking about Ikiru, I don't know if these are necessarily the four greatest films ever made, but I take that back. This is obviously the greatest film ever made. I think it's clear to just about anyone who's watched it. I saw the movie in theaters. I was like, wow, what a perfect masterpiece. And then after college, I lived with two of my oldest childhood friends. And we'd watch this film, I'd say like conservatively once every day on cable. And it sort of became like a religious text to us. So you could sort of quote it in full. And when I got married, I had one of those friends read the lyrics to Jason Segel's Dracula song part of our wedding vows. You can now hear my baby crying at the product of that wedding in the background, but she's just crying because she wasn't there to hear this in person. It was quite a moment. And I do think word eventually did get back to Jason Segel that people were incorporating the song for Sarah Marshall into their vows. And I think for my money, this is sort of the clear highlight of the Judd Apatow comedy era. I think it's hard for me to say with any sort of objectivity when I say, like, not that comedy is objective by any means, but like when I say like the funniest movie ever made, I mean, so much of that is because of how many times and with whom and under what conditions I've watched this movie. And it every line is sort of, you know, eclipsed being a line in a movie and become something deeper and more like hardwired into me. But man, I just fucking every part of this movie, it's so perfect to me. What does the world think about Forgetting Sarah Marshall? Am I alone on this island?
There's a lot of reviews about Jason Segel's Wang. I know that much. Sure. I was cycling through lots of reviews. So this is actually the first time, again, that I'd seen this. I had held off on this movie since release. I don't know if I just had like a group of friends that saw this and wouldn't shut the F off about it. So I immediately like went introvert mode, like, I hate this movie. I'm never going to go see it.
I know that
so I did finally watch it and I enjoyed it. And I look back on that era of Judd Apatow and like that crew. It's so crazy to look back on that period of several years where it almost felt like the same crew was in those movies like constantly. And I was looking at Jason Segel's filmography. This isn't negatively like really a slight, but like so many of these movies feel like they could be those fake movies within a movie poster. Like, you know, those titles that like, but these are legit. They were all made around this era. They were all super popular. And it was crazy to look back on just what an era like Apatow and friends had. Like, I don't even know. Will that ever be replicated in like modern day?
Ever is a long time. But I do just want to piggyback on that and say that I think Jason Segel writing Forgetting Sarah Marshall when he was 25 or 26 is more impressive than Orson Welles writing Citizen Kane when he was 25. I think history will show that I write about that and we should be talking about it more. But both impressive, one plenty more so. That's all I'm saying.
I wanted to mention, right. So the Orson Welles thing, I did notice IndieWire posted this list, right, of the greatest romantic comedies of all time, in which Forgetting Sarah Marshall is ranked as number 6. On there, which I'm sure, David, you surely had.
We published a lot of lists that I have nothing to do with, and that may have been one of them.
You wrote the blurb for it, so. Yeah,
wow, there you go.
And you described in your blurb for it that it is the Citizen Kane of its time, but you also said that it's one of the wiser and more honest portraits of how the right kind of hurt can help you steer away from the wrong kind of happiness. And I wanted to ask you if you could elaborate a little bit on that, because I think that's really beautifully said.
I have no memory of this list or writing that, but I think we've all in our 20s found ourselves, or maybe not. I really shouldn't speak for everyone. I certainly found myself chasing after things that even in the moment I knew were unhealthy for me because they scratched the sort of itch or told me something that I wanted to hear about myself and fulfilled some image I had for myself and would end up blowing up in my face. And then they, and somewhat inevitably, if you're listening to them, sort of point you in direction towards and satisfaction and a contentment that is much deeper than even the one that you were chasing the first time around. And that's just part of growing up. But I think this movie and its various characterizations, as cruel as it is to Sarah Marshall as a character, I'm really good at sort of illustrating that. But like Kristen Bell is like Mila Kunis, all these people are just like hitting grand slams. A fucking Russell Brand with seems to be an increasingly noxious celebrity presence with every passing day. And certainly I don't think COVID and all that shit was healthy for a conspiracy minded person like him who needs to be an independent thinker about all things and do his own research and all that. But his energy is like so perfect for this movie. Paul Rudd as Kunis. I mean, come on. Like every little bit part is just flawless. Now I'm just, you know, if you don't stop me, if you don't interject, I'm just going to just
well, you described Paul Rudd's performance as being like a live action Pixar character, which I think is so apt. Like that is right on the money.
Truly, I'm not even kidding when I say that for my friends and I, this movie is infinitely more quotable than Casablanca. Like every utterance in the film is just taken on a life of its own.
Do you guys remember the marketing campaign for this with like the billboards and like the "You suck, Sarah Marshall," like "Fuck you, Sarah Marshall," and like "Okay, Slim." So there were billboards like across the country, like that said, like, screw you, Sarah Marshall. And it was just that. Like, the premise was that Jason Segel's character, like, paid for these billboards and was, like, you know, telling her to F off. But Sarah Marshall's throughout the country were, you know, harassed and upset with this marketing campaign. Like, imagine driving to work and seeing a billboard with your name on it saying F.
Honestly, Mitchell, if I drove to work, if I were on the subway to work and saw an ad that said, you know, screw you, David, I'm going to be like, that makes perfect sense.
I get it.
I'm sure I deserve that, whatever I did, and just to go about my business.
Some list that you wrote that you made 20 years ago that you don't even remember making.
Exactly. That's one of the dangers of Letterboxd as well. Those 5 years or all the things that I posted were just drunk somewhere, not thinking this thing was on.
I mean, look at the filmography for Apatow over the course of just a few years. Superbad, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Pineapple Express, Step Brothers, Knocked Up is in there, Talladega Nights, and 40-Year-Old Virgin. 40-Year-Old Virgin was probably my Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
I mean, 40-Year-Old Virgin was my Sarah Marshall, you know, before Sarah Marshall, and in some ways, another perfect film.
Also, that set the craze of, like, those posters. Remember all those posters, like, with the kind of bright pastel colors?
Great poster. They were killing marketing campaigns there for a bit.
And Knocked Up, which has its issues, is also, if you find yourself in a position where you're expecting your first child, there is really no other movie that I feel like walks you through so many of, in a very contemporary way, the sort of emotional journey of being, even if you are not, you know, having a baby with somebody you met and had sex with on a one-night stand, I still think so much of that, the movie and how they are preparing for the baby and even just the logistic steps of doing it and what it's like to see that OBGYN and find a doctor who's not going to be on vacation and to run to the hospital that night. I mean, it all is great third trimester prep if you find yourself in that position.
David, give me your quick take on The Bubble.
Oh, The Bubble is in a move of extreme generosity, I like to do Judd Apatow the favor of forgetting that movie exists, which is something that comes very easy to the rest of the world.
But, we all wish we could.
Listen, there was a global coronavirus pandemic.
We were figuring it out.
People were struggling. they're all doing what they could to get by. And I wish they hadn't sometimes.
I rewatched This Is the End. It's not Apatow, I don't think, but I just rewatched This Is the End for the first time since that came out. That one felt more like a COVID movie than The Bubble did.
Sure.
Just the way that was filmed all in like the same house and like green screen for the outside. That one felt way COVID now than it did when it came out.
God, that movie takes me back. That was a product of a very particular moment in time. It's even more so than any of these other comedies we're talking about.
Michael Cera, all coked out in that movie.
Coked out Michael Cera. That would still play. I think coked out Michael Cera is a timeless character.
Where's the Oscar for Cera in This Is the End? That's the question. Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, 1985. Mitchell's boy, probably both your boys, Paul Schrader. 4.3 average. The synopsis, a fictional account of the life of Japanese author Yukio Mishima, told in four parts. The first three parts relate events in three of his novels, The Temple of the Golden Pavilion, Kyoko's House, and Runaway Horses. The last part depicts the events of the 25th of November, 1970. This one, I was actually doing a little bit of a pre-show prep. What TV show was I watching? The Dick Cavett Show had Paul Schrader on ahead of the release. What an amazing interview.
I'm sure.
But in that conversation, it was kind of like evident to Dick Cavett and the audience that like, they didn't know what they were getting into with this movie. They were trying their best, but how did you get into this movie? What was your introduction and how did you view it at the time?
I mean, I think like so many of these movies, it was through the Criterion DVD, but I do have a very vivid memory of going to see the film on the big screen at Film Forum. And it was introduced by Paul Schrader. And this is my first like real encounter with Paul Schrader as a persona. I was obviously familiar with his works as a screenwriter, but this was like the real inflection point for me and my interest in him as a director. And he walked into Film Forum with like a fresh, huge hot dog stain, a ketchup stain all over the lapel of his shirt and was like, I'm Paul Schrader. And I was like, what, in hindsight, like what a beautiful, perfect introduction to this man. So honest, so telling. But it's also, you know, speaking about Ikiro and like these movies that are sort of gaining in the collective conscious and growing increasingly popular, Schrader has had a real resurgence in interest, I think in part because he's become such an internet persona, for better or worse, and in part because First Reformed, I think, really was another creative resurgence for him. But I feel like that hasn't really trickled down to Mishima yet, which is funny to me because not only is it the most sort of virtuosic of his or almost anyone's movies, but it is sort of the platonic ideal of his man in a mask cinema. You know, there's like a guy who has a job, and he's the quote that he says all the time, and I've used in print and obviously can't think of right now, where he's like, there's a man in a room and his job is his mask. And it's much cleaner when I think of the actual quote. But the, this is a movie about a man who quite literally wore several masks, and then in a single suicidal act sort of found a way to become the mask that he was, that he wanted to wear, the most beautiful of the mask to his mind that he wanted to sort of be immortalized as. And in doing so also found a way to take off the mask at the same time. And like this sort of cuts to the core, particularly because he's doing so through such a sort of transubstantiating act of violence. It feels like the sort of text for Paul Schrader. This is Travis Bickle. This is whatever the guy's name was in First Reformed. I mean, like this is all these movies that he's made, from Light Sleeper to now Master Gardener. I mean, like, this is the nexus of all of them to me. And also sort of the one that is most elastic and alive, and it just has so much going on, and has maybe the greatest score ever written for a movie. Shout out Philip Glass, my boy. Yeah. I saw him in a Whole Foods once. Seemed chill. I mean, this movie left an enormous impression on me.
Yeah, this is, let's see, I had the stat up here. This is number 57 on the Letterboxd, 250.
Is that true? Wow.
Yeah, number 57. It's on the truly excellent most fans per viewer Letterboxd list. And those are the movies with the highest ratio of fans in their top four faves to member views. I didn't even know we kept that stat. That's a pretty cool stat. Jack Cole wrote one of my favorite reviews, "Killing Yourself to Own the Libs."
Killing yourself to own someone is a recurring theme in Paul Schrader's films. You know, not all of his characters go through with it. Spoiler alert, yes. Yukio Mishima did. That is no secret. It's the first thing you learn when the movie begins. What did you guys, especially if you were, I mean...
This is the first time viewing for me. This was another first time viewing. Yeah, I had heard of this movie. You know, First Reformed, I think, was my first modern entrance into Paul's like current work, and First Reformed I loved, and then I was like, it started to open up and I was like, oh, I need to start kind of watching some other things. So in true Letterboxd fashion, I think I probably looked at my friends' like reviews of various Paul work. So I'd heard about this, and I know like Lucas's name was attached at some point as like a producer and Coppola and stuff like that. And then I started to go into, this is like a weird roundabout way before I watched this movie, but I listened to the director's commentary of Dracula with Coppola. And he talks about Schrader. And then I listened to The Last Temptation of Christ, director's commentary with Schrader. So I finally sat down to watch this kind of like with all that backstory. And I was honestly blown away. Like these might be my favorite set pieces of any like film that I've seen in the last 20 years. I couldn't believe what he was able to pull off in what presumably was a mainstream movie. And that's why I referenced that Dick Cavett interview. Because I think I saw some reviews even said that, like, how did this movie even happen in its, like, current form, right?
With friends like George Lucas and Steven Spielberg in 1985, you know, as Akira Kurosawa learned himself in 1980, you know, things could happen. Was it a mainstream movie? I don't know. It was budgeted $5 million. It made about $500,000. And so, right. You know, with Schrader's movies have never been guaranteed moneymakers. No. But it's definitely, you know, even by his standards, a big swing. Mm-hmm. But just even for its aesthetic beauty in a way that Yukio Mishima, his vanity, could appreciate. Because this is a movie that has a very nuanced and complicated relationship with its subject, where it's not, you know, necessarily endorsing, I don't think, you know, like so many Paul Schrader films, not necessarily endorsing the beliefs
subject matter,
or
yeah.
The subject matter, but also having a clear and palpable admiration for the willful myth and the dedication and the follow through that these characters have. But Akuishikawa sets are unbelievable. Philip Glass's score, as I mentioned, is just going absolutely nuts. It's a really symphonic piece of work. And when you look at so many of Schrader's more aesthetic films, you know, the sort of monk-like and monastic movies that he makes, and you think of, any of his recent films, really any of his other films, period, this feels so far removed from them. But at its essence, to me, I would argue is the most Schrader of all of his movies. So it's a really fascinating sort of conundrum.
Yeah, I really love that because I came to it kind of late in my Schrader obsession. He was already like my favorite director. I had seen most of his stuff before I had seen Mishima. And I had, you know, the same kind of thing where like aesthetically on the surface, it's like, it seems like a departure for him. But when you get into like the nuts and bolts, it is a film that is examining like living in the world as an artist and experiencing this conflict between feeling like words aren't able to have enough of an immediate impact, if any at all, versus direct action feeling like its impact is too fleeting. And you can like, Schrader always feels like he's a guy who knows that there is so much wrong with this world and struggling with figuring out like what he can do as just like one person trying to like say, like scream into the void almost, but like try and find some sort of connection.
Yeah, I mean, it's listening to you say that, it is sort of interesting to think about in context with Ikiru, because so many of Schrader's films are, as you said, about trying to find ways to have an impact in this world. And, I watched this as basically the furthest thing from like a hard right Japanese nationalist. But I can sympathize with, to a degree, or at least understand Yukio Mishima's his frustrations with, you know, what he's able to do and the various forces that are conspiring to lead him to feel like this is the best way for his, not only to make an impact, but also like the purest form of his self-expression. It's also a great gateway to just reading Yukio Mishima's books, which are wild and obviously get a taste of in this movie. But Forbidden Colors, which is one that Mishima's widow refused to allow Schrader to use in the movie, is particularly interesting if you get a chance to read it. But also, like, you know, in this age of the most boring ass biopics that we have to deal with all the time, this is like textbook how it's done. Like, this is what's possible of this genre. And this is why I am, one of the reasons at least why I'm so reflexively frustrated by these womb to tomb, animated Wikipedia film biopics, because it's, you know, to have a film where its form is so inherently expressive of its subject, it's transformative. I mean, this obviously you wouldn't want to take the Mishima approach to a movie about somebody else, but it is, I think, a textbook example of what happens when you actually listen to the subject of the biopic that you're making and make a movie that is informed by who they were and not just, you know, the bullet points of what they did.
Yeah, I loved Joe's review on Letterboxd, which speaks to that. Joe said, "I seriously doubt this even crossed Paul Schrader's mind, but this handily sidesteps almost every biopic pitfall there is, from the huge ones like not formally interesting to more insidious ones like drawing rote, superficial connections between life and work. Biopics don't have any style. This movie has Schrader juggling four or five different styles, all with their own thematic purposes and their own interconnected threads."
Hell yeah. Good Lord. Paul Schrader, come home. Come on.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to get another Mishima-like movie out of him anytime soon or ever. But he made one, and I am very grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. What's the new one? Master Gardener? Is that out?
Master Gardener.
Next,
yeah. It is.
It'll be out by the time this episode drops. Yeah.
It's a lot more First Reform than Mishima, but
it definitely, I mean, it ties into like First Reform. I mean, he said it plenty of times. First Reform, Card Counter, and Master Gardener are definitely like a thematic sort of trilogy of examining just figuring it out.
Yeah, and you get Light Sleeper and American Gigolo and all these other movies that are part of the same.
Yeah.
The same King Caboodle, but that's the straighter way.
I loved this list on Letterboxd for Mishima from Janice. The list is called The Masculine Urge to Ruin Your Own Life, which I feel like applies to so many of Schrader's movies.
I mean, it's so, yeah. I mean, Ken Ogata, who plays Yukio Mishima, his demeanor during the last day of Mishima's life, which is like very paternal. He's often smiling as often as he's being, very militaristic and severe, is really wild, given that you know what he is planning for that day. It's just something that strikes me every time I see it.
Yeah, the movie has like these really fascinating ruminations on like the idea of like the quote unquote perfect death, like the best time to die, the best way to die, like how your death could be most useful. And like, David, I was curious on more like a personal level, like
about what I'm thinking about my own death and what my boss.
Honestly, in a more uplifting way, like if you knew that like it was your final day, like how would you want to spend like your final day?
Mitchell, I basically watching this movie yesterday, for the umpteenth time. I'm 38 now, and Mishima's whole spiel about how like basically when you turn 40, it's fucking over and your body is shit and no one will ever.
Two more, buddy. Two more. You're still
like,
going.
This man. Look close to home, buddy. also, I feel like, if Mishima saw what I consider my physical peak, he would probably kill himself just out of embarrassment. My perfect day? I don't know. I feel like that answer gets cheesier with every passing year, and it should.
Why not? Yeah.
Yeah. I think, 20 years ago, it would have been like seeing like a Radiohead concert and doing MDMA and on a lake with my friends. And now that actually sounds great. I would love to do that. Especially if I had a place to sit during the Radiohead concert. No more winding up on the rail for me, man. This is going to get like really silly and fucked up and stupid. But, there are so many annoying things about me, but certainly one of them that people cite is that I find ways to complain about privileges very easily, because I'm just someone who's like permanently stressed out and can turn any seemingly nice aspect of life into something to mine stress from. And in my case, that I tend to be traveling for film festivals. It was one of the things that made me want to become a film critic, because I loved it so much and I still love it so much. But now leaving my family, particularly my 3-year-old son, is just like absolutely the worst agony that I've ever known, even if it's only for 2 weeks, which is so melodramatic of me, I know, but I became a father right before the pandemic. I mean, he had barely left my eyesight for like 2 straight years. And the separation anxiety I felt the first time I had to go to Cannes, when it was started up again, which, again, it's just like so awful to complain about going to fucking Cannes. And I'm not complaining about the experience of doing it. It's purely just about, having to go anywhere away from my kid. It's so, so hard. And I'm giving this whole preamble because I get really dramatic about it in my own head in the days leading up to Cannes, which we are now. I leave for Cannes as of recording this in 72 hours. And as my kid gets older and he understands that I'm going away, it becomes sort of mutually traumatic. So I think about these days before the trip, not necessarily my last days on Earth, but they have that same charge of like, how am I going to spend this time? Mm. Like how, every second that I spend looking at my phone instead of, playing with my kid when I'm with him, it feels, triply wasteful. I don't know. It's a long and maudlin way of saying that it would probably be just spending, I also love my other kid who's just 3 months old. Uh-oh. I don't really have the time to connect in the same way, but we'll get there.
They're going to listen to this and be, kind of pissed. I'll be honest, buddy.
Love you, Ray. Shout out. You were a little blob now, but one day you'll be a person. But the film festivals have become a really, really clear way for me to sort of measure the trajectory that I have bonded with my kids. Cause I remember I had to go to Sundance 6 weeks after my son was born. And the only feeling I really felt in that moment was just an overwhelming sense of guilt for my wife, who had, even though we had talked about this 10 months in advance at that point, it was just, I felt so horrible about having to leave her with our newborn. And then the next time I had to leave, I had a little bit of guilt for my wife, but was overwhelmed by that anxiety of leaving my kid. And it was such a clear indicator of how, my feelings as a father to this person mm-hmm. had evolved over those it was like 18 or 19 months. And I can already feel myself on that trajectory with the second kid, which is a long way of saying that, you know, when I, if I'm lucky enough to still be going to Cannes or anywhere in 2 years from now, I will have double the anxiety that I do now, which is really fun to look forward to.
I had a mental image of like David thinking back to his child at home and like swaddling clothes, but when the camera pans in closer, it's just a DVD of Forgetting Sarah Marshall. There's no child.
You know what? That I'll check out. That's not a bad idea. In a pinch.
I'll say the good thing for your kids, for you, for everybody, for us, for the whole world, is that you're not traveling to Cannes on the RMS Titanic,
wow.
the basis
ding, 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 ding,
of
ding.
Our final film. You know, 1997, James Cameron, do we even need to give a synopsis? What's the table setting for Titanic? It's fucking Titanic, people. David, tell me about the first time you saw Titanic.
I mean, the first time I saw Titanic was the weekend that it came out in movie theaters. I was just turned 13, and I had been told, I'm pretty sure, an apocryphal story about how my paternal grandmother was supposed to be on the Titanic, and whoa. I think that was just bullshit. I still do, because it never really seemed to come up again, but I remember distinctly believing that at the time, because, you know, I needed more of an emotional in to this, I guess. I was like, no, I'm not seeing it because of, like, the Leonardo DiCaprio craze, you guys. Like, it's just, like, I'm just like personally related to the story. You know, Leo died so that I could live. A bargain that would, you know, make millions of women the world over, you know, rent to their garment. I saw it. I loved it. I was 13. It didn't really go any deeper than that. But then thanks to a wonderful invention called cable television, it quickly became, and still to this day remains, the movie that I've seen more than any other movie ever made. It is, I think it's mostly true that it has been playing on some cable channel at all times on a constant loop since 1998, a few months after the movie in theaters. So, and I have been watching it almost all of those times. And you know what? It never fucking gets old. It always, always hits. And every time, I mean, this is truly a magical film. It's a movie, you know, speaking earlier in the episode about movies that are more than the sum of their parts. And there is a really enchanted feeling to this film, you know, whether it's James Horner's music or just the incredible special effects works or, you know, just really how they all sort of harmonize together. A harmony, not of pen and sword, but of like a fucking, I don't know, teen heartthrobness and and beautiful CGI. But it is like such a transportive movie. It's the romance, while basic, is like so sweeping, and there's nothing that, and if you'll see this across the movies that I love. I mean, I've often been sort of mocked in a way as someone who is like really drawn to, especially for like a straight cisgender man, for a lot of like queer and gang queer love stories, because they often speak to something that has always resonated within me, and maybe more so than other kind of romances, which is a sort of, you know, unrealized or unfulfilled longing. I mean, for me, the beginning of that was Roman Holiday, which is not at all a gay love story, but the ending of that movie has always been so like deeply baked into my idea of like this aching sense of love that I have always, as an emo kid growing up, always found really romantic. And it's a feeling that resonates very strongly in everything from, you know, thinking of these recent films like Call Me By Your Name and Carol and Portrait of the Lady on Fire. And that is, you know, above anything else that I really responded to in those movies.
Did you go see it in 3D when it was re-released in high frame rate?
I didn't. High frame rate would be tough for me. I didn't see it in 3D. I actually haven't seen it in theater since 1997.
Fake fan.
I was planning on going. Yeah, I am a fake ass fan. I was planning on going for the most recent re-release. It was just this Valentine's Day, but this fucking daughter that I keep talking about had to be born. I was able to steal like a week before the baby came. I was able to sneak my wife into a
She is not going to like this episode. Right? No. I'm going to be honest.
So he hates Letterboxd and podcasts in general. So,
I mean, I saw Titanic in theaters. I saw it in theaters. I was like 7 or 8 with my mom. And she, during, you know, the draw me like one of your French girls scene, she covered my eyes, classic mom move, because I couldn't see breasts. Little did she know I was developing a massive crush on Leonardo DiCaprio. And I would soon demand that we rent The Man in the Iron Mask on VHS from Video Gallery every week.
You would shortly thereafter be apologizing for renting Man in the Iron Mask. she's like, Mitchell, there like, are other Leo movies to choose from, please.
I just want to see, there's two of them in this one. I got to see them both.
Sure.
But Wood on Letterboxd mentioned, you know, seeing it in theaters is one experience, but Wood's review says that they watched this for the first time as God intended on 2 VHS tapes.
Hell yeah.
Take us back to the 2 VHS tapes. I love Slim and I both, we've got the 4K TVs, we've got 4Ks. I've got, you know, my collection has been discussed, but the VHS tapes, the double VHS tapes, there's something magical about those.
Oh yeah. I mean, you'd always see like what incredibly arbitrary moment would be the changeover.
The cut. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, it would just be the middle of like Rose being like, well, dance with me. And then they put it in be Jack or something like that. And yeah, I mean, there was a real weight to it. When you went to the video store and you saw that fucking brick, and you were just like, yeah. Tonight, this is not an average Friday night. We're about to meet business over here. And it did.
We need 2 Stouffer's family sizes.
Oh my God. Hell yes. What a date night. My God, I'm sweating just thinking about it.
I do maintain, you know, my controversy about this movie has never been, and like nothing annoys me more than the whole fucking thing about how there was room on the door for both of them. I mean, there's literally a scene in the movie or a shot in the movie where he tries to get
they
on
try.
It and it
they
flips
try.
Over. I mean, it drives me fucking crazy that people keep talking about this. But what I, my fan theory that I have like to cultivate that James Cameron has also spoken out against and disproved, but fuck him. What does that guy know? Get to the author. You know, I'm all for that. It's really all about how we feel. Is that Jack and Rose making out caused the sinking of the Titanic because the lookouts were too distracted by them on the deck? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Cameron says
too hot.
Cameron says they wouldn't have had time to turn either way, and I say that you know it was worth it. But I don't know. Do you guys pick up at all what I'm putting down in terms of like how this fucking magical this movie is.
I love James Cameron. I'm like unabashed Cameron super fan. And when Avatar came out, I thought Avatar was okay when it came out. But even if I didn't love it, I was going to tell people I effing loved it just to F with them because I hate when people bash Cameron. And then when the second Avatar came out, I freaking loved Avatar. It's almost like you're a fool to bet against this man.
Sure, it sure is like that.
Because like, I mean, what other... And even I kind of doubted, like, is there really a way he can make like a good sequel to this and make people care and have it make money? But like, he's done it time and time again with Titanic. He just somehow knows what to do in a final product of a movie to get you to care about these characters. Like, I unabashedly also love True Lies, and that's like a flawed movie for sure, yeah. But so much fun to watch that movie.
But I think that he needs you, like, he's like chasing an ever increasing high as you build up the tolerance to it. Like he feeds off of your inability to believe that he's going to be able to pull it off. It's like, you know, yeah, I saw Titanic. I was like, you know, masterpiece. I was excited for Avatar, but then the commercial wrapped. I was like, I don't know. And then, you know, I saw Avatar and, you know, I generally liked it. I certainly was doing 3D better. It had a disastrous effect on the film industry in some respects. But I, you know, even with my whole never bet against Cameron ethos, I was certainly on board with that idea. The idea of like 4 Avatar sequels and then like seeing the trailer for this, I was like, I don't know, Jimbo. I don't really think this is going to work out. And then sure enough, Avatar Way of Water fucking ruled.
It did.
Even now, I'm like, do I need another Avatar movie? Like, is that a really good idea?
Remember the scene at the beginning of Avatar 2 where it's like, they show them land, shifting into Avatar 2. But like when the big machines come down and they're like creating a habitable landscape on the planet, it looks insane. Like it's like Terminator 2 special effects, but modern day. And like when I think about rumors that one of these movies is going to be taking place back on Earth, like I'm already all in on like Avatar 5 on Earth. Like that sounds like the most insane thing ever. James Cameron doing that.
I'm going to bring us back to Titanic.
No, I refuse to go back.
I haven't seen Avatar 2. I'm on record of not being an Avatar fan, but I love Titanic. So I want to bring it back to a place where I feel comfortable. And David, because we've been making this a very death-themed episode, I want to ask you, who would you be on the Titanic? Would you be Rose and Jack looking for one final grasp of love? Would you be Billy Zane self-preserving by any means necessary? Would you be the band dedicating themselves to the art as it all goes to hell? Who are you on that ship?
I don't know if I have the hair to pull off the Billy Zane. She's all I have in the world. Although one of my favorite lines, I mean, so many of my favorite lines from movies are in this movie, but certainly, you know, one that actually has a common use in my life is some variation of, I put the diamond in the coat. I put the coat on her.
How many times have you said, I'd rather be his whore than your wife? How many times?
I mean, today, to my wife? even in my worst moments, and there are many, I don't know if I have the energy to be Cal Hockley, the waspiness required. I think, I don't know. I mean, Victor Garber's character has always sort of bugged me. I'm not chivalrous or noble enough to be the captain and go down with the ship. I feel like the watchmen who are like fucking off on their jobs and watching these hotties on the deck make out, like that is probably where I would end up. I think if we were doing like a school play in Titanic, based on where I would be cast in terms of talent, a one-line role that is pivotal to the story, but still is just one line, is probably where I would slot in. So that checks out. Or the guy wearing the watchman shirt on the boat in the present day sequences.
Okay, so we're running out of time, David, but you mentioned that as a recording, you're hitting the road to Cannes.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
As much as anxiety ridden it is to leave the family for a certain period of time.
And I don't love flying. I would sooner, you know, if not for the fact that it would, you know, greatly lengthen my trip, I would sooner take the Titanic or the Titanic 2, which is a real boat.
How long would that trip take on the Titanic?
It would be about 6 days. 6 days.
Good Lord.
You know, five if you really push the boilers, regardless of what you might hit along the way.
So what is anything at the top of your list that you're like, I need to experience this, I need to see this, I need to do this for this particular trip?
Yeah, I have seen Killers of the Flower Moon, which is, you know, the sort of double-edged sword of now I have more time to write about it, but it's also, I'm flying halfway around the world with my family, and one of the things I would be most excited to see is something I've already seen. Mm-hmm. I'm sure everyone will be talking about this by the time this episode comes out. Although, I won't say there's, you know, by this point, by the time this comes out, there will be opinions, mine included, public
discourse.
Discord. There will certainly be discourse. And that's really all I'll say about the movie. There will be discourse. You can say that about any movie, but definitely this one. I'm very excited to see Droid City. There's some of the obvious ones. Jonathan Glazer coming back for the first time since Under the Skin with Zone of Interest, which I'm told is a real deviation away from the Martin Amis novel on which it's based. Always, even though Hirokazu Koreeda's two movies that he's made since Shoplifters, which I think is a masterpiece, and Won the Palme d'Or have been a little bit disappointing, the fact that he's back in competition with the movie Monster is really exciting. There are so many. There better be. Todd Haynes has a new movie.
Todd Haynes, buddy.
Like, he is a guy who really never misses for me. I'm told that, and that includes something like Wonderstruck. I'm told that May December is kind of in its tone, kind of catty and funny, and a throwback to some of the movies he was making a little bit earlier before the prestige-iness of his, you know, 21st century films kind of took over, and that sounds fun. There's a bunch of stuff. I'm hoping there are things that are not necessarily at the top of my list that end up blowing me away, as the mark of a great festival a lot of the time. I'm looking forward to seeing my friends and drinking enough rosé that all of my entitled blather about missing my kids becomes, at least for a few hours, a distant memory, and that I'm able to, you know, take stock and enjoy and appreciate the gift of being there. While I am there, and try to keep my anxiety and my clawing at the walls to get home feelings to at least just like the last day or two. That would really be the dream.
And if not, just fire up that DVD of Forgetting Sarah Marshall in the hotel room and,
exactly.
and
all is right with the world. I'm going to pop it in the flat where I'm staying every night and just like have the, because like when you wake up in the morning after you fall asleep during the movie and it's just gone back to the DVD menu, it's looping.
On loop.
Ad infinitum.
Just have like, the Nathan Fielder, like the setup with the laptop, like on the desk in front of you that you have wired around you and you're just walking around all the cues at Cannes. You've just got Forgetting Sarah Marshall playing at all times.
It's extremely on brand. Just as a closing touching story for this episode. Just talking about DVD menus takes me back to like when I was in my mid-20s and I would take an Ambien every night and watch a movie and I would invariably, you know, fall asleep 20 minutes in the movie, forget everything that I'd seen and just wake up to the movie's menu looping. And I did that when trying to watch Solo or the 120 Days of Sodom, took me like 7 days because I would have to start over from the beginning every time. And so for like a week straight, I would wake up just to hearing the menu of the Criterion DVD looping and getting into my head through osmosis for hours on end. And I strongly felt like that was going to be what broke me and just extend me down a spiral of depravity from which I never recovered. And maybe it did. I don't know. Maybe that is the root of my trauma and psychosis, but not something I would advise to anyone. But I did eventually make it through the whole movie and glad I did.
Our guest today was David Ehrlich, and you can find him on Letterboxd using the link in our episode notes. Thanks to our crew, our editorial producer, Brian Formo, our booker, Sophie Shin, Sam for the art, Monica for the theme music. I think Gemma might have written this, and the wonderful Slim for tightening up all the pauses and rambling. Ew. Interesting. I didn't write that, so.
Thank you very much, Mitchell. Very kind of you to say. But if you're listening to this, maybe consider leaving us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify as it helps spread the word about the show. And you can always shoot us an email if you want, podcasts@letterboxd.com. We love getting email. The Letterboxd Show is a Tape Deck production.
This is a Tape Deck podcast.